The CEO closed the door and said, I want to tell you something. You've got the job, but do you want my advice? Like the advice I would give you if you were my daughter. Why don't you put your head down, grow that little firm of yours and sell it to us one day? Why don't you do that? You know, part of life is knowing when you're in a luck moment. That was great advice.
So here we are. AI is changing everything. It's a threat. It's an opportunity.
So let me take that one step further. I think the most powerful thing reputationally now and into the future will be what ChatGPT has to say about you. ChatGPT not only crawls, it thinks. It connects dots. It gives you an opinion. And I believe that that is going to be critical. All the data shows, video, audio, people want to consume information in a different way. The podcast is one of the most effective second meeting strategies, meaning if someone listens to this podcast and they like what I have to say, am I having the first meeting with them when I meet them? I'm probably having the 10th meeting. They know what I have to say. They like it and they want it.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining, I'm your host, Simon Brewer. Quick word before we start. 95% of viewers aren't subscribed, so miss out on future interviews with top business, finance, and industry leaders. To support the show and ensure we can keep sharing high-quality content, click subscribe and please drop a like. Plus, if you have any future guest ideas, do share your suggestions in the comments section below. Otherwise, thank you for watching and listening, and enjoy the show. Today's episode is titled Good Investor, Poor Communicator. And as I started my prep, I thought about why so often you find great managers who are less effective communicators. But it actually made me think that this might be a bigger conversation encompassing suggestions which can serve as a guide to progress, especially today when AI is expanding its footprint, disrupting, facilitating, replacing. And then it begs the question that is the power of the spoken word actually assuming greater importance? It's the tension of literacy versus oracy. And since I had to look up oracy, it is the fluent, confident, and correct use of one's language. So communication in a changing world beyond financial services is going to be critically important. So who better to have the conversation with than Jen Prosek? Jen, welcome back to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It was Feb 23 when we interviewed you last. You feature on our corporate video, and we start these meetings with this 2.5 minute video of some great clips. And my family know absolutely that the killer line is the two most powerful words in business are just ask.
You got it.
And they are delivered by you and they resonate. So you are, for those who haven't listened to that episode and hopefully will go back, you are the founder and you are the CEO of Prosek Partners. It is one of the world's leading marketing and communications firms that I guess for nearly 30 years has helped some of the world's top asset management groups. I think those clients of yours might actually oversee over $60 trillion in public and private markets.
Not right.
Which even in devalued dollars is a large number. I'd like to just start with the private asset industry today. A lot is going on at lots of levels. Just give us a sense of how the industry is evolving.
Sure. Well, to rewind back when I had this crazy idea that private markets firms would actually care about marketing, we probably talked about this last time, but I still call this space the emerging market of marketing. It's still an emerging market. I still get calls from $100 billion managers saying, okay, we've gotten religion. We got to get on the front foot. We got to have a brand. We got to be proactive. So, but having said that, I do not have to convince any private markets founder that brand matters anymore. Everyone has that notion squarely in their head. The question now is how to activate small, medium, large. What is your goals? Are you after the wealth channel? So what's really driving the conversation now is obviously money raising, sourcing, talent finding, and should I tackle the wealth channel and how do I do it? Because the wealth channel is really driving the need for GPs to become almost like consumer brands. It's consumer marketing. You're reaching financial advisors and their high net worths. And that ends up being a whole different kettle of fish. Instead of reaching thousands, which would be institutions to raise money, you're going to you know, hundreds of thousands or maybe millions if you're really targeting lower down the chain of the high net worth. So it's a very exciting time for our business, obviously, because everyone all of a sudden cares about brand.
Yeah. And in fact, it's timely because by the time this episode has been released, we will have released Hugh Van Steenis, who's one of the leading experts on the private asset space, talking about private credit and where it's going. And we have a little bit of a disagreement on, you know, on maybe some of that, which hopefully everybody, you know, will enjoy, and firms who are thinking about it may find interesting. So before we get into the meat of this conversation, let's just pause on ProSec Partners. You talked about, you know, thinking that religion would come to your part of the world. But I think I remember you telling me a long time ago that, as is so often the case, somebody, a mentor, there was somebody who really helped you think about why you should be brave enough to do this on your own.
Well, yes. So I graduated college in a recession, which meant I didn't get my job of choice in the big city of New York where I wanted to be working. I moved back into my parents' homes in the suburb of Connecticut, and I started a network, and I ran into a gentleman who wanted to start a communications firm. Nothing about him or the opportunity was appealing, but it was in my chosen profession, and I decided to go work for him in a very undesirable place, in an undesirable office with undesirable clients. But I figured I would do it for a year, and then when the market turned, I would get out of Dodge. That was the start of this. I never left. I tried many times to leave. What really happened, and I'll try to make the story short, is, you know, the market did turn. And I interviewed in New York, and I successfully end up in the CEO's office of a very large global firm called Fleischmann Hillard. And the CEO closed the door and said, "I want to tell you something. You've got the job. Everybody loves you. But do you want my advice? Like the advice I would give you if you were my daughter," who's probably in his 60s. I'm in my 20s. And he says, "Why don't you put your head down, grow that little firm of yours, and sell it to us one day? Why don't you do that?" And his name was Jan Van Meter. And, you know, part of life is knowing when you're in a luck moment. That was great advice. Had it not been for that advice, who knows where I would be today? Maybe I would be successfully a CEO for hire somewhere else. But that was the moment I got very serious about going back to my desk and figuring out, where is there a white space to grow this small and ugly firm I have into a beautiful butterfly, which it is today.
Thank you. Just give us the quick recap on where you are and how many employees.
So we're about 450 people. We're global. We're number one by far on every league tables in the private markets. We're top three in M&A transaction communications. We work for corporations too, but a full half of our firm is the financial private markets.
And let's just talk about the competition, because there's disintermediation everywhere we
Definitely.
Look. Where are your disruptors? What's making you look over your shoulder?
My competition back in the day looked at our idea of serving the private markets and laughed in our faces, because there wasn't any spending there. They were obsessed with the Fortune 500, the publicly traded world, the FTSE 100 world, and that made a lot of sense. That's where the fees were. So we were the only game in town on this side for a long time. Guess what? The private markets are the it girl now. So our competition wants our business. So, you know, our world has become much more competitive. So we have focused on rolling out very proprietary products and solutions.
Okay. You've been very clear about what you term, and I love the fact always that the English like to use different language. You call it nailing the narrative. We might say delivering the investment message. But some investors are deep thinkers. They're not natural communicators, and storytelling might feel a bit light to them. How do you think about striking the balance when you're talking to some of these principals?
Well, first of all, I use a rubric when I talk to principals called talent, deals, and capital. And I say, how would you like to increase preference and efficiency when fundraising, capital, when sourcing deals, and when finding the best people to work for you? And they go, tell me more. So if we do our jobs right, and you're in a fundraising cycle, if people are attracted to your brand, if LPs think well of you, if you have a good reputation, and then if they know your story before you sit down in front of them for the first meeting, are you having the first meeting or the second meeting? You're having the second meeting, maybe the third meeting. You have advanced the process. You have created efficiency in your fundraise. That rings founder bells because that is bottom line. So everything we do at ProSec is very bottom line, and it's usually around creating efficiency and preference in talent deals and capital, right? Nailing the narrative is our way of saying that it all starts with your story, your narrative. What are you telling? What's your elevator pitch? What's your right to win, right? And I do a lot of moderating at conferences where there are LPs, so I get to know them. And I would say about 75% of them would say not many GPs can nail their narrative in the first meeting, which is a problem. It's a real problem. It's a business problem to solve. And listen, you know, most of my clients weren't English majors, right? This is not their sort of sweet spot. So helping a client nail their narrative, giving them the language which makes them distinctive and memorable, it's actually priceless.
Right. But of course, the other thing about the business of investing is that it's data driven. I remember when we interviewed Scott Besson, I said to him, how did he reflect on being a hedge fund manager who was gay? And he said, the great thing is it's the numbers, you know, they speak. So when you are dealing with these firms, however much they get the branding and however sort of slick they've become, they need to perform, you know, as well. And is there any sense amongst your community of nervousness that we've had a big tailwind, that things have gone very well, but, you know, maybe there's trouble ahead? We've had a few early waves sort of smashing against the bow of the boat when Trump Tariffs 1 came in. How cautious or optimistic would you describe your client base?
I think the client base is a little of a tale of two clients. Half the clients are raising money very quickly and feeling very buoyant. The other half are not meeting their fundraises and feeling very vulnerable. So, you know, we are in a private markets time of disruption, right? Am I going to try to become a publicly traded Apollo, Blue Owl, Aries, or am I going to be the best I could possibly be as a niche player, private equity only? Am I going to go into wealth channel? Am I not going to go into the wealth channel? There's opportunity, but there's also stress. So it isn't just the stress of the economy. Is it a good, you know, PE economy or a bad PE economy? It's also making the right business decisions as you scale your business, I think, has become much more treacherous and complicated than it used to be. But there's much more opportunity. Actually, Ian Charles from Arctos, who you know very well, has an unbelievable talk track on how firms will scale, what their right to win is in the future, you know, what it's going to look like. So I would encourage you to call him up and ask him about his vision for the future.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. Yeah, well, that was Ian Arctos' interview on sport and finance. Was fascinating. He dissected that whole ecosystem, you know, brilliantly. But Well, you've mentioned some of the big brands, and underneath that are lots of, you know, very large firms. I think it may be, again, an expression of yours, which I'm now going to hijack, but which is the sea of sameness. A lot of folks are doing similar things, and you're talking to lots of those folks. How do you approach this differentiation?
Yes. Well, we get under the hood with a client, obviously, and figure out what is it about their firm that is different and special, right? Is it the business model? Is it the culture that's driving returns? What is it that is different and distinct to them that sort of defies the sea of sameness? And I would say, you know, most of the time we are able to find something that is very special about the firm, whether it is business model, culture, approach, you know, you name it. And then we have to package it in a way that is interesting. The issue with the sector in the past, a little bit less so now, is people were so afraid to be different, afraid to be a little edgy, afraid not to be boring. And we've sort of encouraged them to push the envelope a little bit with the way they package their message. Because the reality is, without differentiation, you have a very inefficient way of getting people to want to work for you or invest in you or what have you. So I think that my advice is to obviously listen to the experts, but also be a little less afraid to tell your authentic story and what really makes you different.
Okay. So you mentioned it earlier on, but it would appear to me that the freight train is moving down the path of democratizing private assets. Never the risks, whatever the issues. And that was back to my conversation, you know, with Hugh Van Steenis, but Scott Kleinman talked about it, you know, again, when we president of Apollo. How do we think about, and you've hinted at it, but how do you think about the messaging? And it's back to my thing about literacy versus oracy. What are those key skills that are going to be required in taking what has been a, you know, a sophisticated institutional sort of, you know, set of, you know, products and widening them?
Well, it's always thinking about the audience you're trying to reach. Right now, even though some firms are trying to reach the end-to-end high net worth, the first stop is the financial advisor, right? So figuring out what do financial advisors read, where do they go, what conferences do they go to, how do I influence them, how do I get my message to them, and how do I get my message to be consumable in the language they speak, not necessarily the language of the institutional investor. If you ask me, what is the conversation going on in boardrooms? Well, of large asset manager PE firms that want to now tackle the wealth channel. It's this friction between feeling like, you know, if the words velvet rope, at least in the US, are used a lot, this mystique that we used to have when we were quieter and institutional and LP only. And now all of a sudden we're going to ruin our mystique with this like mass broad marketing campaign. Well, it's hard to do both things. There's a little bit of friction in the middle there. So I think that is where a lot of firms are, is like, are we going to go all the way with the wealth channel and all the way with this consumer marketing, or are we going to protect our velvet rope? You know, so and I think that's an interesting friction. So you kind of have to be all in on wealth or it's not going to work. So, you know, you're not going to send out a few press releases and think you've conquered the wealth market. You have to do regular earned media, regular thought leadership, regular content, and paid advertising, likely, and sponsorship, and larger activations, and larger spend. You are also competing against Franklin Templeton, BlackRock, PGIM, huge asset managers who also want that share. And guess what? Those firms spend between $25 and $150 million a year just on advertising. So the private markets world is not really ready always for what they need to do to compete. And I'm not saying you have to spend that much money. I'm just saying put it in perspective to what retail marketers do and spend to really make it happen. It's a whole different ball of wax.
Yeah. And in fact, it now makes me remember, having spent a lot of time in Morgan Stanley, that safeguarded in the 90s, that sort of, you know, slightly prestigious sort of, you know, image. And then it did the deal with Dean Witter. And there was a lot of, you know, questioning of culture. But, you know, at the time, there were some who saw the direction of travel. And, you know, so this is not without precedent. You've also said, you've talked about using these opportunities to present yourself and for the firms to think about how to maximize impact. And you've talked about the magic of convening. Which again, it's not a word that we use necessarily a lot. I quite like it. Just talk to me a little bit about what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, listen, I think in the wealth channel, just coming off of that, the wealth channel is really all about, you know, a little more mass marketing and a little more repetition. But, you know, I am a convening addict. And what that means is I learned a very long time ago that gifting a network to someone is the greatest gift you can give them. Because one new contact can change the game. It could change your life, could change your career, could change your kid's life, it could change your company's direction. So many moons ago, I realized that convening is powerful and giving the gift of a network is a powerful give to your clients, to your prospects, to your friends, what have you. So more than 10 years ago, I embarked on regular convening of CEOs and founders in this space. And the idea was, I want to gift you a network. And that's been the most magical part of my business. You know, even if you're running a $75 billion GP, when you rock up to Davos, who's getting all the invites? Well, it's Jamie Dimon. It's not you. Who's getting on the TV? It's Jamie Dimon, not you. So there is, like, you're powerful in your space, but you may not always have the best network. You may not always get the best invites. So I created these convening events where powerful people can meet powerful people on a regular basis, expand their networks. And, you know, so many transactions have happened on the back of these convening situations. Kids have been hired by each other's firms. Like, you know, it's so much magic has come off. But of course, that's an unscalable way to market. That is not a wealth channel strategy. That is more of a high level, what they call bottom of the funnel kind of strategy, where you're getting in front of the people you want to get in front of in small rooms. And Simon, there's not anyone who convenes better than you. So you know the power of convening better than anyone.
Well, I was actually going to say my co-founder, Will Campion, is actually the great networker like you. But we have found, and I know you couldn't make our dinner with Scaramucci the other day, by bringing people, you know, into my home and having dinner and breaking bread. You know, a lot of really good stuff happens with all sorts of people. But the other thing, and it's sort of a little bit of my bugbear, and we've been fighting against it, is the sort of the dominance and ubiquity of the PowerPoint has been, you know, forever. And we have this second channel, the curated channel, where firms who are raising finance are now increasingly coming and saying, well, you know, how do we put together a short, you know, video interview, which helps us, you know, instead of the first meeting. Question to you is, you know, at the cutting edge of communication as you are, how are people thinking about the tools they deploy in a world where I see PowerPoint still wherever I go?
Well, first of all, I think we're in a more creative multi-channel world where things like, you know, if you look at the adoption of LinkedIn, pre-COVID, you wouldn't find one GP founder on LinkedIn. Now, you know, check out Mark Lipschultz at Blue Owl, check out Orlando Bravo, check out Robert Smith. They have robust content programs on their LinkedIn. Why? I mean, John Gray has chosen actually a retail move with his running videos. Why are they doing that? Well, they've realized that LinkedIn is a place where LPs go, financial advisors go, talent goes. It's a business channel. So if you can build your own channel directly to audience, that is extremely powerful. So I think the nice thing about the world of GPs is they've gotten a lot more creative about experimenting with channels. But back to the deck problem, I do think, I think the deck may live forever. Having said that, all the data shows video, audio, people want to consume information in a different way. For instance, you know, the podcast has taken off like crazy. And I always say the podcast is one of the most effective second meeting strategies. Meaning, if someone listens to this podcast and is interested in branding and they like what I have to say, am I having the first meeting with them when I meet them? I'm probably having the 10th meeting. I have accelerated. They know what I have to say. They like it and they want it. So, you know, I do think podcasts, for instance, a conversation between you and a founder about the firm, the philosophy, the culture, the performance, everything, that's a more interesting way to consume if I'm an LP. And by the way, I could do it on my treadmill. So I do think that there hasn't been as much experimentation as I think there should be in solving the PowerPoint issue. But I think we will see that change a lot in the next few years.
And it, all of this is coming back to this, you know, this communication orally. I have said to, you know, my children who are fed up with my lessons to them, and they're all, you know, grown up right now, which is that you may not be the hardest working, and you're certainly not the smartest, with all respect to them, but you have been given the gift of the English language, and make sure you use it and you can master it, because the ability to deploy it, you know, in an Anglo-centric world, you know, is absolutely key.
Because— so let me take that one step further. I think the most powerful thing reputationally now and into the future will be what ChatGPT has to say about you. So if you haven't asked ChatGPT, what is Simon Brewer's reputation, you should. ChatGPT not only crawls all the information about you, it thinks, it connects dots. It gives you an opinion. And I believe that that is going to be critical. I also think, to your point about being a great communicator, you can't prompt the machine well unless you are. You have to be experienced, not just in your field, but an experienced communicator. I always think, like the former journalists here who all they've done is ask questions their whole life. Communicators, all we do is ask questions our whole life. Guess who's great at prompting the machine and getting good at it? We don't have to get good at it. We're good at it. So I do think that's an interesting thing to think about in terms of the future. You know, how will communications affect, be affected in agentic AI? I think we're actually pretty far ahead of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. I mean, I've experimented to see what happens in prep for an interview when I ask, you know, whichever engine it might be. And it clearly comes back with some well thought out. They may not be particularly, you know, different or original, but then typically in 7 or 8, one or two might be going in a direction. And yet, you know, it's only by studying, you know, your experience at Columbia and, you know, other things that you or others might have done, that you intuitively pick up things which are, you know, they're the subtleties of life. And so therefore it comes back to the oracy. It comes back to the ability to, you know, weave together important or seemingly unimportant events that tell a story.
Yes, I'm going to give you a chat example that I think is really powerful back to convening. So I'm usually the moderator at my convening events. Why? Because I want everyone to shine in the room. And since every founder is a star, I want to ask them the most interesting thing about them so that everyone else remembers them, right? So like you for your podcast, I do a lot of research on everyone all the time. I can upload an entire list of people onto ChatGPT and say, what people know each other? What people don't. Have any of these people ever done a deal together? Any relationships? And in the amount of time it would take an analyst to figure that out, ChatGPT can do in a matter of seconds. So I'm a fairly big fan and experimenter.
Yeah. Well, I've got, we have a number of interns who come through, and we've got a very smart young lady called Isabel Potter with us. She's in the room. She's nodding vigorously about this AI. So, you know, I better stay up on my game.
Yes.
That's great. Now, there's some other things that you've said, and I want to just bring them to the surface so you can expand on them a bit, which is that, you know, and clearly, you know, there are many people, we're in 130 countries watching, listening, so everybody's got their cultural norms and, you know, and acceptances. But you always say, don't be afraid to approach people in the hallway. Just tell me, how do you encourage people to do that for whom it is not a natural thing to do?
So I'll go back to the mantra you started with in the beginning of the podcast. I believe the two most powerful words in business are just ask. And that kind of gets to the idea of not being afraid to approach people in the hallway. Too few people sort of leverage the power of the question or the power of the opportunity to introduce yourself and ask a question. You know, I run a firm with a lot of young people. I always say this because it's true. Ask me how many young people a year write me a note and say, could I come in and just spend 5 minutes with you? maybe one a year. That's crazy. So as you know, I write a LinkedIn newsletter. And when I was an intern and I decided I want to get to know the senior people, how can I get the senior people to care about me? Well, I decided to solve a problem. And this gets to my next gen thing about friction points. I worked in a suburb and as an intern in an office in the middle of nowhere. And I watched the senior people come in, rush in late with their coffee and their breakfast. And you'd have to get in your car and go to the shop to get your coffee and breakfast and then come back and bring it back. And you're probably late and you're a mess. And I said, you know what? I'm going to come in at 7:30 every morning and I'm going to go to the senior row of people and I'm going to ask them all what they want for breakfast. And I'm going to go fetch it before the day starts. So what was I doing? I identified a problem and I solved it. Look for problems to solve. And every day I took their orders, I brought them breakfast, and then I did my job. And by the end of the internship, they threw me a party and they offered me a full-time job. So I think like that's a little different of a version of don't be afraid to approach people in the hallway. But I think that too few junior people leverage the opportunity for a senior person to become their mentor because they're either too afraid to ask or they don't ask. People don't ask for things. The only reason I got good at it is I was in my early 20s doing a job I should have done in my 40s, and I needed to ask people or I wasn't going to get there. But I got really good at asking.
And the other two words that we all know but often underestimate their power, and those are thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you is magical. And I want to say that people, you know, yes, they care about their salaries and bonuses first, perhaps, but recognition, saying thank you, celebrating people, it's free and it goes so far. I would also say at the end of every PowerPoint presentation, we have a slide that says thank you. Do you know how many times a CEO has said, why don't we have a slide that says thank you at the end of our decks? You've basically had an hour of someone's time just to thank you. So I'm actually big, you know, I'm big on the watching and listening for the moment where somebody doesn't think you're paying attention and then sending them a thank you because you are.
You also said that you're a fast failure gal. How, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, as an entrepreneur, the beauty is you try a lot of things. And that means you made a lot of decisions. And sometimes you make decisions that don't go right. And it's really important to fail fast, meaning call them out, stop and make a pivot. Too many people don't want to say that they've failed at something. So they hang on to a bad decision a really long time. Like think about hiring. If you've hired somebody that was your person, your decision, your whatever, say they're a flop. Some people want to hang on because it's embarrassing to say I made the wrong decision. I'm never embarrassed to say I made the wrong decision. When you're an entrepreneur, you get very, very good at understanding, you know, that you've got to try a lot of things and some of them will fail. You have to know when you've got a failure on your hands. You also have to know when you've got a success on your hands and really max that out. That's equally important.
Yeah. And as an investor, I know my biggest mistake over the years has been not cutting a bad position when the evidence was growing because, you know, ego gets in the way. You've also said that you've mastered or you've moved towards a minus mindset. And it reminded me of Pete Davis of Lansdowne, who's such a great investor. And he talked about he deliberately takes several things off his plate every year to create capacity. How do you do that? How do you work out what you don't need to do?
Yeah, well, I think you know, we have a lot of people here, right? And they're very busy and people are our business, right? You know, we bill hours like lawyers do. All we have is our people. And you tend as a leader to want to ask people to do more and more and more and more, especially the good ones. You just pile on their plates and plates and plates. And sometimes you have to have a minus mindset and take things off people's plates and sort of look at what am I asking people to do? And are they the most, you know, the best and highest use of those people. You know, interestingly, I think that's the positive of AI, right? AI is going to optimize the things that we really have to do and minimize the things that are probably should be minused off many of our plates.
The other thing that I don't think is talked about much, and I joked with Hugh Van Steenis the other day that he goes to Davos and, you know, really there seems to be a lot of ego, you know, at work. This is an industry. The investment industry doesn't have a shortage, you know, ego and self-belief, which leads us to that other quality, humility. When you're in a room with CEOs, and, you know, these are big folks running big businesses, does that, you know, we understand the importance of integrity, but close to that and as important is humility. How do you think the industry grapples with what to many people in the street is still this extraordinary group of people receiving extraordinary compensation?
Well, listen, I always say that we're not communicators, we're chief EQ officers, and our job is to be honest and truthful with our clients about how they're coming across, which is hard to do. But the reality is, as a consultant, sometimes we're hired to be the truth teller because the people on the inside don't feel that they can. So we spend a lot of time being truthful to people about how they're coming across, and that can include lack of humility. You know, I had a tough conversation with a founder not so long ago that he's brilliant, but he dominates the room. He's like domineering. He turns people off. He has to suck up all the oxygen. And it was a hard thing to have to tell somebody, you know, who no one's really said that before. Luckily, in this situation, he was super open-minded. And we've worked on that, and he's improved. Like, I can't even tell you how much he's improved, because he's now self-aware of the fact that he was doing it. And he's completely changed and has become so much more effective. If I get one more thank you note from his team on his effectiveness in meetings now versus before. But you have to be very brave, you know, to do that. And I think I always say part of what we do in our role is to be the truth teller when no one wants to really say it. But, you know, the reality is, if we allow our clients to appear completely unhumble in public, that can have a public response. So it's our kind of fiduciary duty, so to speak, to be protecting our clients and telling them the truth.
Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognized as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients, and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build a more connected and efficient market. Visit LSEG.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance. Different tack, but we as a business support game, girls are investors helping more females get in and stay in the investment industry. You've been, you know, terrifically successful, Jen. You've fought, you know, battles unknown, etc. How have you dealt with this? Maybe even glass ceiling is not even appropriate right now, but how have you dealt with the obstacles that inevitably weigh heavier? And I, Will and myself both have two daughters and wives. How have you dealt with those obstacles as they've come along?
It's such a great question. You know, as a young female entrepreneur, I have to say I had my blinders on for a really long time, meaning like I was just doing my thing and not really noticing that I was often the only woman in the room. I would say this. I think when you're inside a major corporation like your time at Morgan Stanley, it's a tougher environment for women. There are glass ceilings, there are other people's rules, there are all kinds of norms. And I think those women have faced harder times than me. As a female entrepreneur, my view was, Simon, if you don't want to work with a feisty woman, you're just not going to work with a feisty woman. That's me. So in some ways, I had sort of natural selection of the men who wanted to work with someone like me versus. So I really did face far fewer obstacles. And I will say the one thing that's been a positive about being a female advisor is a lot of men have told me truths I don't think they would tell their bro friends. And I've been able to help them along their way and help them become better executives because there was, I think, a little bit more of a natural honesty. That's just a gut feel. But I don't want to diminish how difficult it is for women who are the only female in the room or the space. That's a lonely place. And I realized how lonely it is when I started to get my female CEO clients together and I would hear their stories. So it's, you know, very, very real. And actually, I've tried to gift convening to female CEOs, especially first-time female CEOs, because they need to share and get advice from each other about many, many things, including being a female in a male-dominated world.
So, Jen, you know, the seas are calm, people are feeling good, assets are rolling in, you know, life is sweet, and then stuff happens. Bad stuff happens, which sometimes is exogenous, sometimes it's because the culture hasn't worked or people do bad things. Now you've got a different situation. Now you're being called in to handle the proverbial having flown. How do you deal with these situations?
So first we have to figure out how can we neutralize, you know, something that is negative. Can we do it? And then what does the repair job look like, right? I will tell you first off, a good offense is a great defense. Meaning, if this is why I don't like when people are like, I want to stay quiet. I want to stay under the radar screen. I'm very successful. Why do I need this communication stuff? One of the reasons is if you hit a crisis and say the FT has written a very negative story about you, what is the Google vacuum or the ChatGPT vacuum sucking up? Only that story. And the other bad stories. There's no context. There's no surround sound. There's no way to know you outside of the bad story. If you have a content machine and a content muscle and you are always putting out positives about your company, its culture, its people, its performance, whatever it is, you at least have like this foundation. So there is at least some context around you. So it's not just the bad story. So I think that having a good offense is a good defense, because if something bad does happen, the only way to shift the perception is obviously to be honest in the moment and promise the fixes, but also to flood the zone, so to speak, with good stuff so that there is perspective around the one bad story. I would also say in the heat of the bad story, you know, most of my clients don't think this, but most journalists are actually fair. And a lot of bad stories are very bad because the client didn't participate with the journalist to give the context, to check the facts, to do what has to be done to create a balanced story. So a lot of what we do in the heat of the moment is to make sure that the journalist has the context they need to write a balanced story. By the way, half the time, the journalist has information that is totally not true. So behind the scenes, making sure they know if you write this story, it's going to embarrass you because it's wrong. So, you know, the relationship between the effective communications person and the journalist can be very productive in the heat of the moment, so that the story is at least accurate. But say it's accurate and bad, then you have to get into that repair job. So hopefully that's helpful.
Great. A different strand of your business has been your conference business. I think you have a conference convening business. You are very kindly coming to the Money Maze Allocators Summit. And in fact, you, your team are have managed to secure Todd Bowley, who's going to be one of the very interesting, you know, folks. And I think you and I are going to interview him together on stage, and we've got some great people. But, you know, conferences have endured, you know, pre-COVID, post-COVID, and continue to be extremely important. What have you worked out that has made this such an important segment of your business?
So the what I call the LPGP, you know, conference circuit around the world has become incredibly important for fundraisers. because LPs have changed their behaviors post-COVID to some degree. They like to go to a conference and bang out a lot of meetings. So, you know, whether it's Super Return Berlin or FII Saudi or it's iConnections or it's Money Maze, people are coming to meet LPs and build relationships primarily. So we decided in our business that a lot of our clients spend a lot of money going to conferences and do not maximize the ROI. So if you go to conference, you should get at least three, if not four, areas of ROI. One is brand, because journalists are on the ground there. You can break news at the conference. Another is thought leadership. You should get on stage and be part of the conversation that matters. Show the world how insightful you are. But then there's the hardcore, I want to meet LPs. That isn't always maximized by the firm. We help clients maximize the LP meetings. And then there's the whole, there's about 150 events happening around this conference. What are they? Which one should I get invited to? How do I do that? We do that too. We try to track all the private events happening around these conferences and get our folks into the right events. So when our folks leave a conference, they have ROI on brand and they have ROI on commercial value, whatever that is. And they have ROI on building their network. So that becomes like the conversation turns from like, wow, I'm spending a lot of money. I'm rocking up. I'm spending time. I'm not sure if it's worth it to, oh my God, over those 2 days, I have maxed it out. So the service that we provide to do that is called Conference Concierge. We literally concierge the client to make sure the ROI is super high. Because if you're going to go to FII Saudi, it's a long distance, it's a lot of time, it's a lot of money, and you should max it out there.
Great. Well, we're very happy because we've also got Danny from Saudi Sports who's going to be on the sport and finance session. I have got some closing questions. I wrote them down. I thought, well, let's have rapid fire, the Magnificent Seven. But as was pointed out to me, and people do forget, in that great film, only three survived. So those whose portfolios replicate the Mag Seven, just remember that sometimes it happens. So first one up, you've built this business. What has been the hardest bit?
I should have gone bigger earlier. The hardest bit is when you bootstrap a business and it's your money, sometimes you're cheap on yourself. I should have invested bigger earlier.
Who's the sports star you've met who's impressed you most and why?
Well, I've been lucky enough to interview Serena Williams 3 times, and I have to say she is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. Her discipline and mental toughness is off the charts. Her business acumen is off the charts. She is a serious venture capitalist, which some people, eye roll the celebrities who become venture capitalists. I think she's the real deal. She works extremely hard and her quest to win is monumental. I don't think she would fail at anything.
What advice to the young people who come to you for advice and your daughter and their friends, etc.? What, if you can only give one piece of advice to them as they're thinking about their futures, what is it?
Ooh, this is new advice. In the world of AI, entry-level hiring is going to be treacherous. Figure out what you want to do and get 10 internships in it before you graduate, because you have to have enough knowledge to prompt the machine.
What is your most important daily habit?
Sleep.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go.
7 to 8 hours without fail.
Yep. No, I know the great Margaret Thatcher used to live on 4, but then, you know, there was perhaps a consequence later on in her life because of that. Mm-hmm. Now, why do you love scuba diving so much?
Oh, that's such a good question. I love it because, first of all, you can't really concentrate on anything else. It's dangerous. You hear your own breathing. There are crazy creatures that you're discovering that could be dangerous. You have to pay attention. So it's the one place that I can't be emailed and I can't be thinking about work. But I also, I love an adventure. It's an adventurous feeling. You know, I just went to the Galapagos Islands and dove with hammerhead sharks and sea lions and penguins and all kinds of stuff. And I just felt like I was in the middle of a National Geographic special. And that's my favorite place to be.
Yeah, well, I agree, because I think we had an exchange and I've been with the family and we've been in the Komodo Islands diving, and we're not great divers, but we seem to sort of, you know, be allowed to. And it was extraordinary, is extraordinary. And my final question, Jen, is what is the summit or summit still to scale in your life?
Oh, great question. Honestly, I have one daughter. She's my best friend in the world. We're super close. She will go to college next year. I mean, I think she'll go to college next year. So I think the great summit in my life, my business will continue to summit. I'm pretty sure. I want to become a grandmother and have grandkids. Well, I cannot leave this earth without an only child having her own family and grandkids.
Well, okay, you have a lot of time for that. Jen, look, we've had lots of conversations over the last few years. You know, it's been great working with you and your colleagues, and we've had some terrific conversations courtesy of ProSec, like Howard Marks, like Ray Dalio. So we're, you know, very grateful and very appreciative. And today, I think it's going to be a different conversation because there is a vastly changing world, and I sort of find myself conflicted, because Winston Churchill came up with that quotation, which is the further back you look, the further ahead you can see. And then somebody sent me a John Paul Getty quotation, which was, at a time of great change, memory is unhelpful. So here we are, AI is changing everything. It's a threat, it's an opportunity. But at the very essence of what you do, and a little bit in our little world of what we do, is we think about communicating and we think about its absolute value. And in some ways, its irreplaceability if you get it right. So I hope that this particular, you know, podcast and conversation goes much wider than the financial community. I hope they're, you know, young people out there in schools and colleges and wondering what they might do that can listen to what's been some terrific advice, Jen. So thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be seeing you in London for the conference.
I love the Money Maze. I'll see you there.
Thank you. All content on the Money Maze curated podcasts are for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is accurate at the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the contents. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed. Additionally, please note that the Money Maze curated podcasts are funded by the interviewee or their featured organization, unlike the Money Maze podcast, which is funded by third-party advertising.